Bert, thanks to both of you, and thanks to all of you for following this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's president says the increasing number of terrorist acts in Afghanistan is in line with the United States' destabilizing strategy in the country. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says the government and opposition have agreed to start the process of drafting a new constitution. Plus, Palestinians launch a campaign to raise awareness about the rising Israeli settlers' attacks against Palestinian farmers. We'll bring you a report from Ramallah. Top story this hour. Iran's president says the increasing number of terrorist acts is in line with Washington's destabilizing strategy in Afghanistan. Ebrahim Raisi said the Afghan rulers are expected not to shirk responsibility for the cure of their national security. He also stressed that the Islamic Republic is ready to cooperate with Afghanistan to provide stability and security for the nation. Last Friday, multiple bomb explosions ripped through a Shia mosque during the Friday prayers in the city of Kandahar, leaving more than 40 worshippers dead. In another attack a week before, more than 50 Shia worshippers lost their lives in a Daesh-claimed bombing of a mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. Political commentator Layosh Sazdi says the U.S. is playing a significant role in destabilizing Afghanistan.
If the U.S., as there have been reports by Russia, which are possible, that they have been moving Daesh leaders, members of Daesh from Syria, Iraq, to Afghanistan, and northern Afghanistan, yes, Daesh there will be fulfilling an agenda to destabilize former Soviet Central Asia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all the Muslim Sunni republics, you know, that once belonged to the Russian Tsarist Empire and later to the Soviet Union. But that doesn't mean that the Daesh have alone to, you know, be beholden to the Americans. They can, there in Afghanistan, do whatever they want if they are in league with the Taliban. Probably they're working for both. On the one hand, the idea to destabilize Central Asia and win more members, you know, for the organization and expand their criminal networks of drug trade and human trafficking, that would be fine, peachy king, like the Americans would say. But at the same time, if the Taliban can use them to murder Hazaras, everybody's happy. So maybe they are working for both.
Iran says Tehran is firm in its decision to resume negotiations for the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, but rejects the approach of talks for the sake of talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Iran has not set any preconditions for the resumption of negotiations. He said talks are underway with European parties in Brussels on issues that remained unresolved during the Vienna negotiations. Khatibzadeh reiterated that Iran needs to see a change in U.S. policies and wants Washington to remove anti-Iran sanctions and stop bullying Tehran. Khatibzadeh said Tehran has not seen any such action from Washington so far. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says Damascus and the opposition have agreed to draw up a new constitution.
I've been negotiating between the parties, trying to be able to establish a consensus on how we are going to move forward. And I'm very pleased to say that we have reached such a consensus. And the two co-chairs now agree that we will not only prepare for constitutional reform, but we will prepare and start drafting for constitutional reform. So the new thing this week is that we will actually be starting a drafting process for constitutional reform in Syria.
Peterson said the co-chairs of the Syrian Constitutional Committee will discuss clear principles in their upcoming talks. Each side is expected to offer texts on matters including Syria's sovereignty and rule of law. The Syrian government and the opposition, as well as civil society, have held five rounds of talks over the past 2 years. The committee aims to find a solution to the years-long crisis in Syria. The new constitution would lead to UN-supervised elections. Israeli settlers' attacks against Palestinian farmers and their lands have been on the rise since the beginning of the olive harvest season in the Palestinian territories. To protect Palestinian farmers, a campaign has been launched by Palestinian activists in areas considered to be at high risk of Israeli settler attacks. Mona Candy has more in this report from the occupied West Bank.
The olive harvest season has started in the occupied Palestinian territories, but instead of being a festive season, it's been overshadowed by the sporadic attacks by Israeli settlers like previous years. We visited the village of Al-Mghayyar, northeast of the occupied Ramallah, where Israeli settlers vandalized over 100 olive trees a while ago. One of the landowners told us that settler attacks on the groves have escalated during the autumn harvesting season.
The settlers do whatever in their power to prevent us from harvesting. They till our crops, destroy our lands, and sometimes burn our trees. They try to keep us away from our lands. 2 days ago, over 100 olive trees were destroyed. The settlers are protected by Israeli forces.
As Palestinian farmers here and other villages suffer an almost daily act of aggression by Israeli settlers, a popular campaign called Faza has been launched to protect farmers. These areas are considered to be at high risk of settler attacks during the harvest season. Supported by the Committee Against the War and Settlement, the campaign has attracted volunteers including university students, farming committees, local councils, and residents of the villages.
Every year, Palestinian farmers come under attack by the settlers in areas close to Israeli settlements. We have come to Al-Mughayyar village to help Palestinian farmers in harvesting their products as quickly as possible and protect them against settler attacks.
Al-Mughayyar is surrounded by a number of settlements. Israeli settlers attack Palestinian farmers on a daily basis, but when we appear in groups, our farmers feel safer and the settlers won't dare to attack them.
The vandalism by the extremist settlers have persisted year after year during the olive harvest season in recent years. Observers say these settlements have been set up to encircle Palestinian areas to make life harder for Palestinians.
Olive harvest has never been easy for Palestinian families living close to Israeli settlements. Olive harvest is considered by many of them as a way to stay connected to their land and protect it against the Israelis. This land has been a source of food and income for Palestinian families for generations. Mona Kandil, Al-Mughayyar village, northeast of occupied Ramallah.
Talks between Palestinian inmates and Israeli prison authorities over harsh conditions inside jails have reportedly collapsed. According to Palestinian media, the negotiations broke down due to the Israeli refusal to accept some of the prisoners' demands. The regime has been treating Palestinian prisoners harshly since last month when six inmates escaped a heavily guarded Israeli jail. Over 400 Palestinians in Israeli prisons are on hunger strike in protest at punitive measures, with more joining them. The Islamic Jihad movement has warned that it would not shy away from going to war with the Israeli regime to defend the prisoners. What was initially meant as a peaceful protest by Hezbollah supporters in Lebanon's capital Beirut turned into a scene of terror and bloodshed. People were shot at from rooftops as they were gathering to protest against a judge handling a probe into last year's Beirut port blast. They're accusing the judge of bias in the case. The situation has revived concerns about violence spinning out of control, but Hezbollah Secretary General has some reassuring words for the public. He says the movement will do all it can to prevent Lebanon from sliding into civil war and sectarianism.
Seven people were killed and 60 others injured after a peaceful protest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, turned deadly on Thursday. It all began as heavy gunfire erupted during a rally of Hezbollah and Amal movement supporters to protest against a judge probing the last year's Beirut port explosion, as they accuse him of political bias and being swayed by the U.S. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has accused Judge Tarek Bitar of politically targeting officials in his investigation. The Beirut port blast in August 2020 killed over 200 people, injured around 6,000, and left some 300,000 homeless. It also caused further damage to Lebanon's already fragile economy. Following the unrest, Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement said the attack was aimed at creating civil strife. Hezbollah initially blamed the attack on the Christian Lebanese Forces Party, led by Samir Jaja. Later, reports from Lebanon's Interior Ministry confirmed that the far-right Lebanese Forces Party had started the Thursday shooting in Beirut. Hezbollah accused the Lebanese Forces Political Party of taking orders from the United States and being financed by some Arab countries. The Lebanese president vowed to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Aoun described the incident as painful and unacceptable. So far, Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence.
Well, the uproar and instability and confusion in the region are directly attributable to the United States, to the apartheid entity of Israel, and to the repressive and repulsive monarchy of Saudi Arabia. So the whole issue is basically outsiders doing their best to destabilize the region.
In recent years, the axis of resistance has turned into a powerful front against the U.S. and its allies in the region. Countries like Lebanon and Syria are standing strong in the face of Israeli aggression. Hezbollah is promising to defeat any foreign and Western-backed plots against Lebanon. And Syria says a crushing response awaits Israel's repeated airstrikes.
Abdul Bari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel
mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nuland, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nuland was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has criticized the U.S. for what he called the kidnapping of an envoy.
Snap was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Maduro said the U.S. violated all international rights by taking Alex Saab. It said Saab's extradition was one of the most ignoble and vulgar injustices that has been committed in recent decades. Saab, a Colombian national, is charged in the U.S. with running a network that allegedly exploited food aid destined for Venezuela. He was extradited to the U.S. from Cape Verde and is due to appear in court on Monday. Saab's lawyers have called the move politically motivated. He himself said he would not collaborate with Washington. Caracas has suspended talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Well, there's no end in sight to the volcanic eruption on Spain's La Palma Island about a month after it began spewing lava and forcing thousands of islanders to leave their homes. President of Spain's Canary Islands, Ángel Víctor Torres, says scientists monitoring the volcano have seen no indications that the eruption is abating. Addressing a press conference, he said islanders are at the mercy of the volcano as rivers of lava continue flowing slowly toward the sea. He added there were 42 tremors on the island on Sunday, with the largest one measuring 4.3 at Richter scale. The eruption that began on September the 19th has destroyed some 2,000 buildings and over 700 hectares of land. The eruption has also disrupted flights from or to La Palma. About 7,000 residents have also been evacuated on the island.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
The Saudi government made an intense effort to kill the UN investigation into war crimes so that they and their allies could continue killing innocent Yemenis with impunity. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Daniel Larison, writer. This article is published under the heading Abandoning Yemen to War Criminals. Stay tuned for more. The United Nations body responsible for monitoring and recording human rights abuses effectively abandoned the people of Yemen recently. In a 21-18 vote with 7 abstentions, the UN Human Rights Council, UNHRC, refused to extend the mandate of an independent investigation into war crimes committed by all sides in Yemen. Since its establishment in 2017, the Group of Eminent Experts, GEE, had served as a limited mechanism for holding war criminals in the conflict accountable for their outrages against the civilian population. The Saudi government had fought against the establishment of an investigative group early in the war because they wanted to keep the coalition's crimes concealed from international scrutiny. Now the Saudi government has successfully lobbied enough members of UNHRC to shut down the investigation into the crimes that they and other belligerents have committed against the people of Yemen. The vote showed how indifferent most of the world still is to the plight of the people of Yemen after more than 6 years of carnage and famine. The Saudis have the most to gain by killing an independent investigation. It is the more than 23,000 Saudi-led U.S.-backed coalition airstrikes that have been responsible for most of the civilian deaths in the fighting, and the coalition continues to bomb Yemeni civilian targets without regard for innocent life. The Yemen Data Project has tracked coalition airstrikes since 2015, and it condemned the UNHRC vote as soon as it happened. This is terrible news for all those seeking accountability and transparency in the conflict in Yemen. This decision gives carte blanche to the conflict's belligerents to do what they want with zero accountability, oversight, or consequences, unquote. Aid groups have likewise denounced the Council's capitulation to Saudi pressure. It was the first time since the Council was created 15 years ago that a resolution at the Human Rights Council was rejected. And by all accounts, it was Saudi influence that was responsible for the outcome. The Saudi government stands out as one of the worst culprits in the war, and that is why they are so determined to bury the evidence of their crimes. The independent investigation has documented extensive abuses and crimes by all parties to the conflict. The most recent GEE report in September found that there has been no serious effort to rein in the abuses on any side. With Yemen experiencing an unparalleled humanitarian crisis, the group of eminent international and regional experts regrets that the conflicting parties continue to engage in serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law, and that third states continue to provide arms and military support to parties to the conflict, with little regard for the immense suffering caused to the people of Yemen. Regarding the U.S. role in the conflict, the 2021 GEE report noted that the Biden administration had committed to ending support for Saudi coalition offensive operations, but the report adds, it remains unclear what this terminology means in practical terms. The investigators can be forgiven for not being able to discern what changes the Biden administration has made to U.S. support for the Saudi coalition. The Biden administration certainly hasn't done much to clarify matters in the 8 months since the president made that initial announcement. The humanitarian crisis in Yemen remains dire. According to reports, more than 20 million Yemenis in a population of around 30 million need humanitarian assistance. The World Food Program says 16 million of them are marching towards starvation due to a combination of conflict and a crippling economic crisis. These conditions have been created by the warring parties, and they have created them by using starvation as a weapon. Half the population of Yemen is being slowly marched towards death. The GEE report states that the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen could be substantially mitigated if parties to the conflict began to respect and comply with their obligations under international law. But clearly, that will not happen unless there is substantial pressure on the belligerents to do so. The GEE released a statement after the vote to end its mandate, imploring the people of Yemen should not be forgotten, the people of Yemen must not be silenced. Unfortunately, the decision to end the monitoring of war crimes is typical of the international response to Yemen's war and humanitarian crisis. The people of Yemen are ignored as much as they are because there is no one that can credibly speak for the majority of Yemenis, and they remain trapped in a war that is waged upon them by states and armed groups that thrive on the mayhem. The Saudi government made an intense effort to kill the UN investigation into war crimes so that they and their allies could continue killing innocent Yemenis with impunity. The very least that the U.S. can do under circumstances is to stop enabling their ability to wage war on the people of Yemen. The lack of international support for credible, independent investigations into war crimes in Yemen is a serious blow, but it is not the end of the effort to hold war criminals into account. There are still human rights groups doing the essential work of documenting crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Mutuana for Human Rights is one outstanding example of an organization that seeks to hold all parties to the conflict accountable for their violations of international law. Their work will be more vital than ever now that the Human Rights Council has given up on the country.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region. What's going on? Who are the key actors involved? What are the people saying? And how are the issues changing the future? All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at Afghanistan, where Daesh killed more than 100 Shia Muslims by bombing a mosque. And we will discuss how Britain's actions hundreds of years ago are responsible for conflict between China and India today.
On October 8, 2021, a Daesh suicide attack claimed the lives of almost 100 Shia Muslims and left several others wounded. The residents who were traveling to the mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz probably had no idea that they might not return. Or maybe they did. Shias have for long been targeted by Daesh. The Shias in Afghanistan in particular are easy to identify. This is because the Shia sect in Afghanistan is followed predominantly by the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Hazara.
In 1880, the Hazara community was comprised of landed nobility, peasants and artisans. Now the Hazara community focuses on how to survive and not get killed. The reason is simple. the Hazara predominantly follow the Shia sect of Islam, and as the third largest ethnicity in Afghanistan, they live in ghettos. Because they live in ghettos and because their facial features are distinct from other Pashtuns, they become easy targets. Being Shia and therefore both a religious and a visible ethnic minority, Hazaras are particularly vulnerable. Even before the October 8 bombing, suicide bombings targeting Hazara public events have taken place with increasing regularity, most of which have been claimed by groups stating allegiance with Daesh. These include, in July 2016, the killing of 85 people at a peaceful protest comprised of mostly Hazaras. It was the deadliest attack on civilians since 2002 and targeted the Hazara on the basis of their Shia religious identity. Other attacks include a December 2017 bombing that left at least 41 dead and another 80 injured in a Hazara neighborhood of western Kabul, and an assault in March 2018 that resulted in the deaths of at least 9 people. So why are Shias a problem? Well, right after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the West and allies had feared that the Iranian revolutionary spirit was spread beyond borders. The revolution was religious in nature, thus part of anti-Iran training, which was fueled by billions of Saudi petrodollars and West-made ammo, included propaganda against Shiism directly. Daesh and Al-Qaeda fighters were taught that followers of the Shia sect of Islam were infidels, and thus they not only had a license to kill these people, who followed the same sect of Islam as Iranians were following, but were encouraged to do so.
There is confusion as how Daesh suddenly became active again, just after the US left and just after China announced its support for infrastructure projects in Afghanistan. As Taliban officials shift from leading an insurgency to forming a functioning state, the Islamic State is trying to undercut Taliban's promises, and it clearly seems that there is reason beyond hate. For the US, using proxies to create instability is like a walk in the park. The Taliban now are from the same freedom fighters which the US supported in Afghanistan for its war against the invading USSR. When former US President calls former President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton the co-founders of Daesh, maybe that's the only statement from Trump which is relevant here.
Daesh remained diminished from its zenith. However, since the Taliban came to power after 20 years of conflict, Daesh's Levant Khorasan ISIL-K sector has revived. According to a letter from the chair of the United Nations Security Council, the terrorist group has come forward with a new, ambitious leader called Shahab al-Muhajir. The group is now active and dangerous and positions itself as the sole pure rejectionist group in Afghanistan to sway the hate mongers in Afghanistan among its ranks. This reminisces with how Daesh first came into scene. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad formed a stronger alliance with Russia and Iran. Rebels and Daesh sprung up in the region to take control. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani takes down Daesh in the region. US targets him and kills him in a cold-blooded act of war. Now that the Taliban have come to take control after humiliating the US, and now that they have joined hands with China, Daesh suddenly re-emerges with astute sophistication in Afghanistan. After the Taliban cleaned up the chaos created by US in Afghanistan, China announced $31 million in emergency aid to the war-ridden country in order to help its people. Furthermore, according to Global Times, a member of the Chinese business group in Kabul said that they have already made agreements with domestic enterprises and other organizations to jointly build a platform in Kabul will provide services like personnel safety, government liaisoning, and bank exchange, tax and logistical services to the Afghan Institute, according to Global Times. with rehabilitation plans and bloc formation of China, Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, the US definitely faces a checkmate situation when it comes to geostrategic power struggle in the South Asian arena, and it seems as though Daesh is the last breath which US can take before its influence completely drowns in the region.
Now, for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyai from the Netherlands. He is an author at Covert Action magazine. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyai.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, could you begin by telling us more on the recent suicide bombing, which killed almost 100 Shia Hazara Muslims in Afghanistan, and who seems to benefit from this horrific act of violence?
Yeah, with your permission, I would like to express my sorrow and condolences to the family, to my Afghan compatriots, and I would also like to obviously condemn this inhumane attack against innocent civilians in the strongest terms possible. Unfortunately, this is an ongoing effort to destabilize Afghanistan, and we have seen in the past attacks that targeted both Shiite and non-Shiite groups in the country, defenseless people throughout the country, and these terrorist attacks were mostly indiscriminate by nature. And this has only fueled sectarian violence in the country, and that is exactly what the terrorists try to achieve.
So do you think Daesh's aims are religious or are they political?
I think they're mostly, their convictions are mostly political, but unfortunately they are abusing religion convictions to justify their aim. Daesh is they're a hardcore Salafist group of terrorists, supported and backed by the Gulf states, the Persian Gulf monarchies. They have poured billions upon billions of dollars to bring about such a infamous group of terrorists called Daesh. And their aspirations are very simple. They abuse Islam. And their version of Islam, so to speak, is the one that doesn't allow for any interpretation. They're not very different from what the Taliban is or used to be. They are very strict in their ideology, because let's call for what it is. They're rather an ideology than that they have anything to do with the religion of Islam, which is a very peaceful religion full of serenity. But Daesh, we have seen what they did in Syria. We have seen what they did in Iraq. Killing innocent people, beheading people, even organ-eating terrorists were seen in different footages. So suspicion is bound to arise. They have political aspirations. They want to full-strike domination of Central Asian region. And hadn't it been for countries like Iran, Russia, and China, you know, they could have pretty well achieved their aim, which, God willing, will never happen.
Sir, one last question. How do you see this unfolding in the future?
Well, I always tell to many friends that the suffering of the Afghan people has been immense, ongoing. Unless there is a genuine effort by the international community to stand with the Afghan people and to stop this insecurity in the country. Right now, Afghanistan is facing a huge crisis, food shortage, hunger, famine, you name it. Unless there is the world doesn't act to support the Afghan nation, I'm afraid things will only get from bad to worse. And you also mentioned the rivalry between great powers. I hope that that will come to a speedy and unconditional end, because Afghanistan and the Afghan nation are the ultimate victim.
Mr. Ariyai, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Afghan-Australian scholar and writer Farahonda Akbar says a new shade of narrative is emerging in post-Taliban takeover of Afghanistan about the unending saga of Hazara tragedies, an issue she believes has always been politicized. Salim Javed, a Gothenburg-based Afghan activist and writer, refers to the Uyghur identity of the suicide bomber in Kunduz, noting that his facial features resembling Hazara's made it difficult to prevent his entry to the mosque. Stanford University lecturer Mehdi Hakimi condemns the criminal silence of political leaders in Afghanistan over the massacre of Hazara Shias in Kunduz, saying it sends the wrong message to terrorists.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and China share an ill-defined 3,440-kilometer-long disputed border. Rivers, lakes, and snow caps along the frontier mean the line can shift, bringing soldiers face-to-face at many points, sparking a confrontation. There is a line of actual control where opposing troops maintain their positions and control with it, something like an informal border where both countries are racing to build infrastructure to legitimize control, such as India's construction of a new road to a high-altitude airbase which sparked the conflict in June 2020. The border conflict is extremely important and crucial to resolve, as it has sparked a war between both countries in 1962. But both neighbors are armed with nuclear weapons, and we need to critically analyze really why the conflict exists in the first place.
According to the Economic Times, on 30th of August 2021, close to 100 soldiers of China's People's Liberation Army, PLA, crossed 5 kilometers across the line of actual control, or LAC, last month. The Chinese troops returned after a few hours from the area, guarded by the Indo-Tibetan Border Police, ITBP, so there was no standoff. Even earlier, anti-China sentiments in India were gaining momentum since the flare-up of the border dispute between the two countries last year at Galwan Valley, the first time in 45 years that soldiers died in a standoff between India and China. In April 2020, India moved to curb foreign investment from neighboring countries. These initiatives were taken in a bid to primarily stop Chinese companies from acquiring smaller and financially vulnerable Indian companies. The ultimate goal was to prevent, quote, predatory investments in these companies, particularly from China. A broad movement of anti-Chinese consumerism occurring inside India was also heightened with US former President Trump's visit to India, but very few actually know the reason for this conflict and havoc. Britain ruled over the South Asian region countries for about 200 years, before which the East India Company had already rid the region of its riches. The subcontinent region's global economic share dropped from 25% when they took control to merely 2% when they left. Having control over countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, as well as parts of Afghanistan and China, the British ruled with a divide-and-rule policy wherein they employed division tactics between the people based on religion, political ideas, language, ethnicity, and even skin color. The aim was simple: to keep these people in conflict with each other so that the colonizers could keep control and steal riches meanwhile.
The people of the subcontinent were getting tired and frustrated of the British rule. Despite failed wars of independence and promises of independence on support of allies during the two world wars, the British did not leave. But But after stealing away most of the riches of India and having been faced with a new independence movement spearheaded by leaders like Gandhi, the British were finally forced to leave. The British left the region but made sure that their colonial footprint and influence remained. Power players like China, India, and Pakistan were forced to get stuck in a quagmire because of British policies.
After the British left the subcontinent, there were three conflicts to resolve. One was between Pakistan and India over Jammu and Kashmir, one was between Pakistan, India, and China over Ladakh, and one was between India and China in the Tibetan region of Arunachal Pradesh. During the time British had control over India, the provinces which we see currently in Pakistan, India and Bangladesh were in actual princely states ruled mostly by the favorites of the British Empire who paid taxes to the Empire and showed unquestionable loyalty. The British left it in the hands of the princes of the states to decide which countries they wanted to join. At that time, there were two, India and Pakistan. After the British left, it is inconclusive as to whether Maharaja Singh of Kashmir joined India or Pakistan. War broke out between India and Pakistan in 1948 for control of Kashmir, and both established line of control in disputed Kashmir areas, a conflict which exists till this day. When the issue came between Pakistan and China over Shaksgam Valley and areas in Ladakh, both countries settled it, and while this territory was ceded to China, China also ceded 1,942 square kilometers territory to Pakistan. This was not recognized by India, which still calls the land its own. Now regarding China and India, here is the story. While in control, the British Empire redrew the border lines as they saw fit according to their own interests. Initially, in 1897, the British added the Aksai Chin region in the Kashmir province and transferred it to the Prince of Kashmir. However, in 1899, the British gave the same Aksai Chin region to China. India stuck with claims to 1897 lines, while China stuck with lines drawn for China in 1899. Thus, the confusion. With both countries stuck to the different boundary lines, both claimed Aksai Chin theirs. This was ultimately followed by the Indo-China War in 1962, where India lost some of its territories, while China fermented its control in Aksai Chin. The strife between India and Pakistan and India and China run till this day.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Binoy Kampmark, an author and columnist for The Mandarin. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Kampmark. First of all, could you explain what the situation is between China and India? What is the border dispute all about, and where does it stand currently?
Well, just as a general kind of thing, of course, many of your listeners and viewers would be aware that there's been a dispute, of course, between China and India that has been going on essentially since Indian independence, and also with China's turning over, as it were, to communism, of course, with Mao Zedong. But the significant thing that relates to the current border situation goes right back to 1962, where there was a border dispute which resulted actually in a war. And the war, of course, over Himalayan provinces, and that resulted in a very heavy Indian defeat. And in a sense, that has left a very bad taste in the mouth of Indian officials. It's also meant that both these powers have been in constant rivalry. And the reason why there are issues lately of significance is because both sides have been developing infrastructure, almost teasing and taunting each other on either sides, as it were, in the Galwan Valley, the Ladakh area, as it's called, and have resulted, as it were, in some fatal clashes that took place last year. So there have been these sporadic clashes, but also recent meetings that have not been successful in resolving this particular dispute.
Now, can you tell us a bit more about the background and the role that the British Empire played in all of this?
Well, I mean, the important thing about this, of course, is that the British, as they have done in other parts of the world, have left a very ambiguous legacy in terms of borders, because one of the things that we see in terms of Tibet and in terms of the outlying territorial aspects, if you like, between India and China, are these ambiguous, you know, demarcations, which is very significant. In fact, individuals such as the British officer Henry McMahon famously demarcated a border in 1914 in Tibet. This is not a border that's accepted very much by the Chinese, but it's one of significance. It's the same thing with other officials associated with the British East India Company. They were very famous, of course, in jotting and charting borders in terms of whether powers would observe them or not. But of course, in the aftermath of the British leaving India, and then of course with the event that, you know, with the arrival of Mao Zedong, this almost became redundant. But that legacy, if you like, the territorial legacy, still lingers in terms of disputes over borders.
So the British can say they already left. Why haven't China and India resolved their border disputes, and why haven't Pakistan and India resolved their own border disputes?
Well, I suppose in a sense all of them are linked, because Pakistan itself being an outgrowth of partition, and Indian, you know, the result of course, India failing to resolve its internal differences, and a lot of this being attributed also to British foreign policy. I don't necessarily think it should be attributed exclusively to the British, but nonetheless it's important to appreciate. And of course also the Chinese remembering foreign policy depredations in terms of how they were treated in terms of Western powers. So you've got India, you've got Pakistan, you've got China, and in a sense all these individual countries are jousting or trying to find some kind of equilibrium in the region. And so the British legacy still remains, and you know, Britain itself doesn't necessarily have much of a direct hand, but they certainly have much of a hand in terms of their legacy in disputing territories and so forth. Certainly when it comes to, you know, matters and, you know, as simple as border posts, as simple as you know, the Aksai Chin Plateau and these areas, the British influence is still very much there.
Thank you, Mr. Kampmark. So glad to have you here on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Brahma Chelene, a New Delhi-based strategic thinker and commentator, says the Himalayas have become the most dangerous flashpoint in the Indo-Pacific region amidst escalating tensions between regional rivals India and China. Former Bangladeshi army official and diplomat Shahidul Haq points to blame games between India and China, which he says has made efforts to negotiate a way out of the ongoing border row between them increasingly difficult.
And that was our episode on the devastating bombing in Afghanistan and colonial roots in present issues of the subcontinent. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
Can America's self-styled foreign policy experts be expected to learn from the failures of the latest misadventure in Afghanistan? If history is an indicator, there is little reason to believe the foreign policy blob will learn the error of their ways. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jose Nino Ryder. This article is titled, Don't Expect American Foreign Policy Experts to be Held Accountable for Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. and America's self-styled foreign policy experts be expected to learn from the failures of the latest misadventure in Afghanistan? If history is an indicator, there is little reason to believe the foreign policy bloc will learn the error of their ways. The horrific events of 9/11 inevitably brought the U.S. back to Afghanistan, but this time with a full-fledged military force. To say this military venture was a boondoggle would be an understatement. The financial cost of U.S. 20-year Afghan conflict have been staggering, with estimates from Brown University's Cost of War Project pointing to $2.3 trillion spent in this war effort. Over 2,400 American service members lost their lives, along with 71,000 Afghan civilians during the war. Narratives put forth by neoliberal and neoconservative interventionists regarding the nature of 9/11 attacks missed the mark. The cliché of "they hate us for our freedoms" used to explain why the country was attacked on 9/11 conveniently overlooks the repeated overreach of the U.S. in foreign affairs since the Second World War. Bold political actions abroad generally provoke some form of reaction. Whether it's a blowback on lurid display during 9/11 or the formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a